Hello. In the previous audio snippet, we started to talk about the seventh pillar of the New American Constitution, which happens to be the right to privacy. And we began to discuss how the right to privacy is to understand it correctly, we must see that it's connected to the concept of nakedness. And we mentioned that nakedness refers to one's vulnerability and weakness, and that the right to privacy is the right to have a privacy zone around us where we can be naked in a sense, or be weak and vulnerable, and it can involve a personal nakedness or a nakedness that involves other people that we have invited into our privacy zone. So that includes friendships, relationships where you in a sense expose yourself to the other person and show your weaknesses, your vulnerability. So it goes beyond say what you would think of in like a marriage. It can go at different levels. You can have a friend, just a regular friend, and have a level of nakedness in that friendship. And that's what the right to privacy is intended to protect. So it's a the privacy zone is a zone of relationships where people can be undressed and vulnerable with each other without fear of public shaming. And it can also be a privacy zone where you are the only person there. And we mentioned that that privacy zone needs to be clearly defined, and that it basically boils down to two categories. Your home, what we can consider your private home area, and then the second category would be privacy zones designated by others. So when you're outside what you can call your home, then you are subject to other people assigning you a zone of privacy so that you can be free to be to act in privacy. And we mentioned the literal example of a restroom, let's say in a restaurant. The restaurant does not have an obligation to provide that privacy zone for you. But usually they do it because it's good for business. So once they provide that privacy zone, then once you enter into that bathroom, that restroom, then you can have a certain expectation of privacy. But you cannot make up a privacy zone wherever you are or however you feel like doing so. So if you're outside in a very public place, crowded, full of people, and you want to have a very private conversation with a friend, you can't expect everybody to just walk away and give you a 20-meter radius around you and your friend to have the private conversation. You are subject to others. Yeah, you can try to have a private conversation, but it's at your own peril because you are not in a designated privacy zone. So that's basically the concept of privacy is associated to nakedness. And we mentioned that nakedness is not evil. In other words, that when we were saying nakedness, we're not saying something that can get you in trouble. For example, a criminal revealing to someone else that they killed like 20 people, a year ago, and he's telling you where all the bodies are buried, and that's very, kind of like you could say, let's say it's in the context of a private conversation, that is not nakedness, that is evil. Nakedness is the concept of nakedness is around vulnerability and weakness, where you are exposed and subject to shame, but it's not a shame for having done anything wrong. It's just you being weak. And we, I believe we mentioned a little bit in the other snippet that this weakness or nakedness can include the thoughts or the intention of doing something wrong, but if they're expressed in the context of vulnerability, where you are feeling tempted to do something wrong, and you're talking to a friend because you're trying to overcome that temptation. There, you're in a state of weakness. Your flesh is weak, shall we say, and you're trying to strengthen it, and that's why you're sharing that information or those thoughts with someone else. That's a weakness, even though it may be related to, let's say, committing a crime or doing something very bad. Because your intention is not to brazenly just say, hey, I want to do this, or I did this horrible crime and I couldn't care less. Because if your attitude is not with non-repentance, and it's because you are exposing your weakness and you recognize this as a problem, that you want to do this crime or this bad thing and you know it's not good, and you're exposing yourself, then that is covered under the right to privacy. But the right to privacy cannot be used as a shield to protect evil. And that's the problem that we have allowed into the American judicial system and the judicial system in many other countries, that when, for example, they establish, we mentioned the spousal privilege, where private conversations between a husband and a wife are protected somehow, and if a husband discloses to his wife that he committed some crime, then the wife cannot be asked to testify about that information, because it was in this supposedly private context, very private context. The right to privacy, unfortunately, has been misused or misunderstood to include such things when it shouldn't, because it we have to remember it's connected to nakedness, to vulnerability and weakness. It is not connected to unrighteousness. So the moment somebody starts talking about something unrighteous, and in the context of something where there is no repentance, then that completely falls outside the realm of privacy, and should be treated like any other communication. And if you're sharing privately, quote unquote, with someone something that you did, and you're saying it without any sort of repentance or anything of that kind, you're not sharing your thoughts. You're just exposing something you did. And you are accountable for it, because we also have to take into account that sometimes you feel shame for what you did, but you're still accountable. It's like, you know, somebody killed somebody else, and they might have a sense of shame, personal conscience tormenting them for what they did, but they still have to give an account for the crime they committed. So in that case, then that's not so much weakness, that is something else, or nakedness. But the thing is that if you're sharing something with someone else and you're telling the other person that you did something evil or some crime, then that person can take that outside of the privacy zone and tell the police about it. And you say, well, that was a private conversation. That person had no right to do that. Well, in a sense, you have to choose your friends wisely. And if you tell, if you share something, quote, private with someone, and that private exchange does not involve the exposing of nakedness, but it's the exposing of an unrighteous act, then if that other person chooses to take that information outside the privacy zone, quote unquote, then that's all bets are off, and you're responsible for who you have as a friend, who you share information with. So that concept of spousal privilege that we have built into the American judicial system should be completely removed. And we spoke very briefly about how ludicrous the law becomes when it comes to that. We mentioned that in California, for example, And I mentioned California because that's where I found a website from a law firm that was based in California talking about spousal confidentiality laws. And they were explaining that in California, if you're about to divorce your spouse, then you are free to testify against them. And then we're saying, how does that make any sense? If that we should protect that type of communication, why does the imminent divorce then remove the confidentiality from that conversation when that conversation took place when they were husband and wife in a private setting? And the reason why they have to start adding all these things to the law is because they know this is impractical. There's something wrong with this, but instead of realizing, hey, we have to clean our slate and start from scratch and see, okay, do we really understand what privacy is? Instead of doing that, they just try to put a band-aid on the law and they start adding these crazy exceptions. And we have the same issue with the psychotherapy confidentiality, where if a psychotherapist is listening to someone and that information is could be vital in the resolving of a crime, then unfortunately, under the American system, that information is protected and cannot come out of the therapy session because it's been shrouded in this privacy. But the problem is that we should allow the right to privacy to be defined in such a way that when there's information that was shared in that privacy zone that pertains to an unrighteous act, then it is should be free to be taken out because it's no longer nakedness. And we are misusing the right to privacy when we allow it to protect unrighteousness that is not nakedness per se. And the same thing goes with the priest confidentiality. All these artificial confidentiality relationships that have been established in our American law system. And I was watching a television show called Law and Order, some reruns. Even though it's a television show, it has a lot of realism in terms of laws and court dealings and things like that. And they had this case where a young man confessed to his father about something that he had done and what was in his heart that he really meant to do, commit this crime, and he had no repentance for it because they were trying to use the lunacy clause, trying to the insanity clause to try to protect this young man from having a harsh sentence. And the father was, testified. And at the end of the trial, the son stood up and, or at the end of the testimony, of the father's testimony, the son stood up and said, "I had this conversation with you in private. Why are you sharing this?" And oddly enough, earlier in that episode, they had a case where the cops who were investigating asked a healthcare worker one question. And it was kind of an innocent question, but she answered the question. She was hesitant because all this nonsense about health, the privacy rules associated to healthcare. And so she kind of, in a hesitant way, gave an answer, and that helped their investigation. And that's how they found that he had committed the crime. And all the evidence that came from that got thrown out of court by a judge because it was against the Fourth Amendment. And just so, in case you don't remember, the Fourth Amendment says, under the current American Constitution, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So, in a sense, it is the amendment about privacy, but in a very, very ambiguous way and in a very limited scope. And that's why we always have to take this and start kind of like expanding it artificially. And that's why we really never know what privacy is, as we kind of start making it up as we go along. But that's as much as we get out of the Constitution, the current Constitution, when it comes to privacy. So the judge was referring to this and saying, no, you needed a warrant to get that one piece of information. So ironically, a very private conversation between a father and his son was allowed, and a very simple conversation between a nurse and the cops was not. And you would say, well, isn't this relationship between a father and a son much more intimate, much more private than a consult with a doctor? But under the current American legal system, it seems like that is more private or more holy or sacred than a father-son relationship. So we see this artificial definition of privacy that makes absolutely no sense. Privacy is privacy, and the problem is we just have to make sure that we don't expose the nakedness of others, something that will bring shame, not because of unrighteousness or evil or wrongdoing, but, you know, just because it's vulnerability or weakness. That's what we have to protect. And if and there was another episode from this television show called Law and Order, where a person was in the on a hospital bed, and he was in pretty bad shape, and then he and the two cops were right there by his bed. The nurses came, and he said, "I have to get this off my chest. I murdered these people." And he was he was in a state of distress, and he was just venting, and that confession was thrown out of court. And I know this is a television show, but there's a lot of reality to these things. It was thrown out of confession was thrown out because the cops were not supposed to be there to listen to it. And yeah, he knew the cops were there, but he said it anyway in a moment of distress. And the judge said, well, he said it in a way to expose his inner condition so that the doctors could help him because he was in a state of emotional distress and he had an expectation of privacy. He was in the hospital talking to nurses, and the cops had no right to intervene. But so you see how the privacy concept is just becomes so convoluted and artificially defined, when it should be that no, that person knew the cops were there. If he said, I killed these people and somehow that has some medical relevance, well, that's his problem. He is exposing an unrighteousness, and that is not, does not get protected by his privacy zone. And he cannot define a privacy zone artificially at any moment. He knows the cops were there. If he really wanted the privacy, he should have told the cops to leave. So you see what we're trying to define. It's a different notion. And there's one other thing that needs to be clarified with the right to privacy. It's associated to the concept of nakedness. And it's still, and because of that, it's associated to the concept of friendships, close friendships, and by association, that is also related to the concept of fidelity. And this is a bit tricky, but I hope you do see what we're trying to say here, that the right to privacy is also connected to the concept of fidelity, and to infidelity by association. In other words, when you have a friendship, there is a certain kind of contract that gets developed where the two people are sharing private information with each other. And whenever anyone violates that contract, that silent contract that gets established, then the right to privacy is violated. And again, we're not including confessions of crimes or any wrongdoing. If you have a marriage relationship and one of the spouses commits adultery, has an affair with someone, that's an example of infidelity because they are taking something that belongs to a private setting between two people, and now he's taking that intimacy to another person. So he is breaking the privacy zone that has been established between the two people, and that is a wrongdoing. And even though it might not be, technically a crime under the law, a legal crime, maybe a moral crime, but not a legal crime, that adultery is a violation of the right to privacy. So any act of infidelity is to be considered an act of unrighteousness that is no longer protected by the right to privacy. So if a husband is committing is having an affair with someone, and he's trying to have privacy with this other person that he's having the affair with, that is no longer protected by the right to privacy because he's entering into infidelity. And the moment he enters into infidelity, it's unrighteous. And when it's unrighteous, then it's no longer protected by the right to privacy. I hope you see what we're saying here. So there are two things that are not protected by the right to privacy: legal crimes and crimes that involve infidelity. Because for the right to privacy to be, for privacy to function properly, there is a need for fidelity between the people who are involved in that privacy zone. And whenever that fidelity is violated, then it's no longer protected by the right to privacy, and it can be exposed publicly without any sort of violation of the individual's right to privacy. So now that we have established, okay, there's a privacy zone. Let's say that you're in your home and you have a relative layer of protection of privacy around you. The new American Constitution will grant you that you have a right to that sphere of privacy. That means that just like what the Fourth Amendment is trying to indicate, the government or anybody else, it doesn't matter who, cannot just barge into that privacy zone and interfere and grab information. Now, if there is a probable cause, as the Fourth Amendment says, that you are committing unrighteousness and you're hiding that unrighteousness in your privacy zone, then there has to be a certain latitude for the government or the authorities to enter into your private zone and scrutinize, and whatever they find, just like what the Fourth Amendment says, they have to find whatever they find has to be specific to what they're looking for. So if while they're inside the privacy zone, they see your nakedness, they see your vulnerability, something that has nothing to do with a crime or anything like that, they can't take that out of the privacy zone and expose it. That would be unconstitutional under the new and even the current American Constitution. So there is a leeway or a possibility for incursions into someone's privacy zone, but they have to be justified, and it has to be targeted to finding unrighteousness. And once you find that unrighteousness, you extract it, you make it public. But whatever is private that involves the person's vulnerability, weakness, nakedness, that has to be left behind. You can't take that out to the public along with whatever you were looking for, if that makes any sense. So that means that anyone can be allowed into the private zone for a justifiable reason, find unrighteousness, and then get out. And they can't take anything private out because then the right to privacy is violated. And now that applies to government, and but it can also apply to private individuals. Private individuals should respect everybody else's right to privacy as much as is possible. But let's say that you have a neighbor that is doing some weird things. Let's say that you see a lot of people coming in and out of their of your neighbor's house, and some unsavory characters, and you start to suspect that maybe he is running some sort of crime operation from his house. And let's say that one day you and you're concerned because it's bringing bad elements into the neighborhood, and the neighborhood's becoming a little bit unsafe because this neighbor is apparently doing something illegal. Then let's say that one day you're walking around and you look into the fellow's house. You see through the window, an open window. And you see something suspicious, and you see some sort of illegal thing. Then, if you at that moment, let's say that you have the opportunity to go and see what's inside, and you get close, and you look, you become a bit of a peeping Tom, looking through the window to see what's inside, and you see, oh my goodness, and you see some sort of terrible activity going on, and then you report it to the police. You go back to your house and report it to the police. You would say, well, did he violate the right to privacy of his neighbor? In a sense, he intruded into the privacy zone of his neighbor, but he saw, and but he saw something because he had probable cause. Then he is, in a sense, protected for having done that. Now, if he goes, if he looks in the window and he sees some private moment of his neighbor that has nothing to do with any crime, he has to leave that behind and say, "Okay, my bad. Let me get out of here," and never reveal whatever he saw that had to do with the person's private moment, private weakness, or whatever. Because that is not relevant to a crime. So there are situations where private individuals may inadvertently enter into a privacy zone. Now, if they are like a stalker who is trying to constantly invade a person's private zone, then whatever they see or may not see will probably not be allowed or admissible in court, shall we say, because these people are actively violating the right to privacy. And if we just allow everybody to violate everybody else's right to privacy, and we, if they get lucky and find something that we need to put someone in jail, that the risk of people losing their privacy is worse than the benefit of capturing criminals. So it has to be done with discretion. And but the thing is that the right to privacy, we will know from the start, does not protect unrighteousness. So there is no concern about a wife testifying against the husband. And as we saw in the previous snippet, in California, if two people are not technically married, but they are have been living together for years and they're kind of married under common law, for all intents and purposes, they are husband and wife under common law, but they're not, technically married, don't have a piece of paper to validate it. In that case, they have no privacy, which is ridiculous. They are living in a private setting as husband and wife, interacting as husband and wife, privately, constantly raising a family. Why would the lack of a marriage certificate then suddenly say that there's no privacy there, and then she can testify against him? It makes no sense. It's all very artificial. Privacy is privacy, and the thing is, if we know that privacy does not shield unrighteousness or illegality, then we are good to go. Then we won't have to make all these artificial exceptions. that make no sense. Now, another thing is that the right to privacy, in a sense, we've made it narrower because we are excluding the protection of unrighteousness. But in a certain sense, we should also, it needs to become wider than it currently is. And it has to do with the exposing of someone's nakedness. So if I have a relationship with someone, a friendship, and the friend exposes something to me, something, a nakedness of him or her, and I take that nakedness and I expose it to other people just because I enjoy humiliating people, or I want to destroy that person for some a sadistic reason, that is a violation of that person's right to privacy and should be criminalized. And I'm not sure how easy it is to pursue that in the current American legal system. But under the new American Constitution, the concept of privacy should be, in that sense, broader, that you can go to jail for humiliating someone, exposing someone's nakedness, weakness, or vulnerability, if it has nothing to do with a crime or unrighteousness of any kind, or if the person's exposing thoughts and temptations and things like that, exposing those to the public when there's no actual crime associated to those thoughts or intentions or fears, then that person should be criminally liable and could go to jail, not just pay a fine under civil law or anything like that. They should go to jail just like as if they had stolen or killed or done any other sort of crime. And again, that does not include a case where someone is saying, I want to bomb a public mall, and I want to kill 2,000 people. Those are not expressions of weakness, vulnerability, and nakedness. Those are intentions to commit a crime. That can be exposed. But any other thing, any private things from their personal lives that are exposed, that is a violation of the right to privacy. Automatically, there is a potential for prison time for having committed that. So in a sense, the right to privacy in the new American Constitution will be narrower than what we have right now. And in a certain sense, it will be broader because it will protect our privacy at a higher, more explicit level. And so the thing is that we must emphasize that exclusion of unrighteousness when we deal with the right to privacy. For example, if someone kills someone in the privacy of their home, obviously the privacy of the home does not shield the person from the crime, and any evidence that we can find, even if it's in the private zone of that person, is up for grabs to be used against that person. So, and that goes to the issue of abortion. Abortion is always associated to the right to privacy of the woman and this and that. But in this situation, she has a private zone, her body. But in that private zone, she's now involving a second life form. You know, it's just like me having a friend in my private house and having a private conversation with this friend. If I, during that in that side, that private zone, grab a knife and stab my friend to death, even though I'm doing it in a private setting, I'm not protected by the right to privacy from anyone asking or saying, hey, you know, I heard some screams coming from your house. Oh, that's none of your business, because you should respect my privacy. And by the same token, if a woman in her private zone, now she's hosting a life form to then take that life form and kill it. As you can see, okay, the question of whether it is a murder or not is a little bit outside the scope of this audio clip. But aside from that, you can see that privacy has nothing to do with the issue. You can't use privacy to protect a murder. So the question is it murder or is it not murder? Is it the taking of a life? Is it not a taking of a life? So privacy has nothing to do with anything. If you see what we're saying here, and the reason why it's all become so murky is, again, because the concept of privacy has never been clearly defined anywhere in our legal system. So that's how we can say that the issue of abortion is not an issue about privacy. It's an issue of whether there is a life form there. And based on what we shared earlier about the sixth pillar, the right to life, the argument will become very clear that definitely that is a life form that is higher than the life form of an animal. And if we are going to protect an animal from being tortured, we should definitely protect the fetus as well, because the fetus has all the manifestations of a life. It has a movement, freedom of movement. You know, it's relative freedom, obviously, because it's still trapped inside the womb, but it's kicking, it's moving, it has freedom. It's manifesting one of the essential elements of life, movement. It's also manifesting the freedom to grow. It's growing inside the woman's body, so it's showing that very clear sign. So we can see that the right to life is being manifested in that fetus. It is not just a thing. It's not a liver. A liver is not growing all the time. A liver does not move. You know, if your liver is moving all the time, then you should get it checked out. Yes, it has living cells in it, but it doesn't have a life of its own, and clearly the fetus does. And yes, it's an inconvenience, and you'd say, well, if somebody drops a baby at your door front and walks away and it's a cold night, are you going to leave the baby outside to die? Even though it was dropped on you, you'd still take it in and take care of it and do whatever you can to feed it, to keep it warm until you can find someone who can take care of it. It's a life that's been dropped on you, and it becomes your responsibility whether you like it or not. And in the same way, even if a pregnancy was an inconvenience that was dropped on you like a baby, dropped left in a basket outside your front door, we as a society have a responsibility to find a way to protect that life. If we define the right to life properly, and we define that there are levels of life, we define what life is in the American Constitution, as we were trying to describe in the previous audio snippet, then it will become very clear. Abortion is definitely a destruction of the right to life. And when we honor the right to life, even in animals, then we can talk about honoring the right to life of a fetus, because the argument is always, oh, that's not a human being. You go, well, yes, not a fully formed human being, and you can debate it back and forth all you want, but because the Constitution doesn't talk about the right of a dog, the right to life of a dog or a tree or anything like that, it becomes very difficult to give a legal validity or a moral validity to the life of that fetus. So if the American Constitution is very clear, and obviously when we start talking about the right of a dog, a right of a cat, a right of a tree, you might say, oh, that's getting too far. No, it's life, and we have to define it. We are the dominant life form on the face of the earth, and we have the responsibility to to take care of the other life forms that are below us. But we have to recognize their right to life. But as we said before, the right to life has decreasing levels the lower the life form is. And the lower the life form is, then that lower life form can become the means to an end for a higher life form. You know, that's why the big fish eat the little fish. The little fish becomes the means to the end of the big fish, and the end of the big fish is to continue living. And when we start seeing that connection between right to life, then when you start using something as a means to an end with no regard for it, then you're treating it as an inferior life form. You're not respecting its right to life. And that's what you're doing to a fetus when you just use it as a means to an end. Well, I don't want this anymore. I want to go on with my life. So I'm just going to terminate the pregnancy and take this thing out of me because this is the means to an end. The means to an end is I have to kill this thing so that I can move on with my life. And if we recognize that that is a violation to the right to life of someone or something, then it's easier to protect that life. And I would dare say I don't think anyone could ever argue that a fetus is a lower life form than a human being, because we all are former fetuses. And even if you want to consider it as a lower life form, then you still have to see it as superior to a dog. You wouldn't kill a dog just because it's an inconvenience. You can't take care of it, so I'm just going to kill it. You would never do that to a dog. How can you do that to something that's above a dog? And again, how can you know it's above a dog? Well, obviously, if you have to save, let's say that a woman has passed away, she's pregnant, she's in a fire, and there's a dog, and you have to choose between saving the woman who's dead, but her fetus might be... there's a chance it's still alive inside the belly, and it's 9 months, it's almost overdue, then you would save the woman in the hopes of saving the baby by cesarean section or doing something, rather than saving the dog. As much as the dog, you know, deserves a chance to live, you would choose the little baby, little thing inside the woman's body. So just by that act alone, you're saying, yes, this life form is superior to a dog. So if we make all these things very clear in the Constitution, then abortion is no longer something that's very difficult to discern. And again, if we define the right to privacy correctly, then we know that... it has nothing to do with the issue of abortion, because privacy zones do not protect acts of unrighteousness. And whenever you're in a situation of privacy, you are still obligated to respect the rights of the other people interacting in your private zone. Just because the person entered into your private zone does not give you dominion over the person to do whatever you want with the other person and violate their rights. And there's also the issue of fidelity, as we said. A mother has the responsibility of being faithful and protecting that fetus. When you see a mother smoke, I mean, even liberals, you know, get all Nazi-like when it comes to women and drinking, pregnant women and drinking. It seems like it's taboo. I don't know how harmful it is, and it might be harmful at high dosages. But you know, to be safe, I understand if a woman doesn't want to drink. But it's ironic that liberals who are pro killing fetuses are also at the same time very kind of fascistic about not letting pregnant women drink. They see it as an abomination, because there's a responsibility. It's like we realize the woman, whether she wanted the pregnancy or not, has a certain responsibility to be faithful to that little thing that's inside of her. And whenever she mistreats it and does not take care of herself, you see it as a violation of a relationship of trust and faithfulness that should be there. So from that perspective, she is violating the right to privacy of that little fetus. So as you can see, if we define these rights correctly, the way they should have been defined from the beginning, then issues like abortion and many other things become much clearer, and the law can become much more straightforward. And also, it can protect us, our privacy, at a higher level, because, as we said, the right to privacy under the new American Constitution will protect us from acts of shaming, of other people shaming us by exposing the nakedness that they somehow were able to obtain from us in some way or another, either through friendship or through intrusion. And we would be protected, our privacy would be protected. Now, one thing is, when we expose the nakedness of others, there is one kind of exception that we have to take into account to avoid confusion. If I expose someone's nakedness, for example, let's say that I expose someone for being a cripple, and the person has problems walking, and I'm constantly mocking that person and ridiculing that person and telling people about these incidents where this person stumbled and fell, and I keep mocking them. I am at that moment violating the right to privacy. And that other person could put me in jail under the new American Constitution because I am exposing that person's nakedness. But if that nakedness is somehow related to unrighteousness and to arrogance, and I use that nakedness as a means to expose the unrighteousness of that person, then I am not violating the right to privacy of that person. For example, and let me say this very quickly, in previous audio snippets, you've heard me referring to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as polio boy, the bastard polio boy. And you would say, well, wouldn't that be an example of where you are taking that person's weakness, that person's vulnerability, and using it to shame that person, and therefore you're kind of violating the right to privacy that you're describing right now? Well, yes, it seems like that, but it isn't. Because every time I refer to him as polio boy, I am, first of all, referring to something that is that was publicly viewable by anyone who saw him in a campaign speech. So it's not like something behind closed doors. The American press made a great deal of effort to keep that crippled, you know, state of FDR out of the public. But the reason why it's important to expose him as polio boy is because this man was constantly trying to portray himself as a man of strength who was the savior of the country. When he really wasn't. One of the ways he endeared himself with the American people was I think it was a weekly radio show or program or transmission that he gave every week, every Sunday night, and families would gather around the radio to listen to him. And he'd be giving all these pastoral, comforting talks to people during the Great Depression. And people became dependent on him. He was like their savior. So he needed to maintain that persona of strength. And that's why he went to great extents to cover up his physical weakness. Because if people saw him as this weak person, then it would be more difficult to maintain this false image of a strong man helping the country through tough times, when all he was doing was prolonging the depression through many of the things he did. And he started introducing a lot of social programs that are crippling us to this day. So we have become a crippled nation. He has crippled us through so many things that he introduced into our mindset, the social security system, all these things that have done in the long term more economic and social harm than good. So when I say he's polio boy, I'm saying he is that because his acts turned us into a crippled society. He has crippled us in so many fundamental ways and destructive ways. That's why I have to point out his physical flaws were a reflection of what he was doing to the country. And I, as I've said before, I'm so grateful that he got he was a weak man, because if he had been physically strong, who knows how many, you know, how much more damage you could have done to this country. He was a selfish, self-centered man. And I've said this before, that before FDR, all presidents used to bow out after two terms. They were able to win re-election. They would always bow out and not run for the third term. And that tradition started from Washington. He won the first two terms as president of the United States when the country was born, and he didn't run for a third term because he didn't want the country to become overly dependent on him in that weak state, and he didn't want to become a king. So he wanted a peaceful transition of power where the American people could see, hey, we don't depend on just one man. We are a country, a nation. Of independent people, and we're not dependent on one king, one person to lead us through life. And the American nation was in a much more perilous condition, being a newborn nation back in those days than in the days of the Great Depression, you could argue. But FDR, when he finished his second term, he ran for a third term and he won. And then he ran for a fourth term and he won. And if he could have and thankfully, the son of a bitch died in 1945, I believe. The son of a bitch was killed, and I think he's burning in hell as we speak right now. And thankfully, you know, his reign ended. But he could have continued on and on because he loved people depending on him. He crippled us as a nation. And that's why he deserves to be called Polio Boy. So when I speak of him and I shame him like that, I'm exposing the evil that he did to all of us. And the man that has always been put in this pedestal is this great man of strength, was a man of weakness. And that's why referring to him as Polio Boy is so important, to bring him down to the ground, that he was not this man of great character and strength. He was a good talker, a good manipulator. And he did so much damage, not only in America, but to the world. It took him forever to fight against the Nazis. As you know, we were forced into World War II by Pearl Harbor, which happened on December 7th, 1941. And the war had already been going on for 2 years, the Second World War, for 2 years. And we were standing idly and kind of helping a little bit the UK, helping Churchill behind the scenes, but only because Churchill kept insisting that we help. And FDR kind of reluctantly was trying to help him a little bit, but not too much. Then we got drawn into World War II because of Pearl Harbor. Then he could no longer stand back because he wanted to always be seen as a man of strength. So if he had just backed down and accepted the Japanese doing what they did to us, he would have looked bad, and that's why he reacted. He was a very selfish, self-centered man. So he started getting involved, and from December 7th, 1941, until June 6th, 1944, which was D-Day, when we stormed the beaches of Normandy and did the great invasion of Europe to save Europe from the Nazi oppression, that was a period of, what, almost 2.5 years. So we were fighting mostly on the Pacific front, and a Polio Boy kept holding us back from assaulting Europe. Why did we have to wait 2.5 years for the Nazis to continue their raping of Europe, and you know, for the Jews to continue getting slaughtered in the ovens of Dachau and all these other places? Why did we wait so long? Because Polio Boy kept holding us back. And when we finally invaded Europe, it was just a matter of time. After June 6, 1944, less than 1 year later, the war was over and we had won. But by doing all of this, we also allowed the Russians to gain ground. And they took half Europe. So we kicked out one dictator and it got replaced with another dictator, Stalin. And he gave away Eastern Europe at Yalta, at the meeting in Yalta, when after the war had ended, and Churchill and Chiang Kai-shek and Stalin, I believe, and Polio Boy got together to decide what was going to happen. He basically gave Stalin free rein. Do whatever you want. You earned it, brother. You fought on the Eastern Front and you kicked the Nazis out. Now Eastern Europe is yours, man. Do whatever you want. And one of the reasons why he did it is because in his heart he was a socialist. So to him, communism was not such an abhorrent concept. So he enslaved, gave away Eastern Europe to the Soviets, and they oppressed the Eastern Europe for 45 years. And who do we have to thank for that? Polio Boy. Churchill was trying to say to FDR, hey, this is not good, this is not good. He was concerned that we were giving away Europe to this oppressor, and FDR couldn't have cared less. He died away, went to hell, and left Eastern Europe under oppression, crippled by Polio Boy. And that's why I keep referring to him as Polio Boy. He was a terrible, terrible, terrible person. Self-righteous, arrogant, and incompetent. But he was a good talker, and that's what convinced people. We got into a state of dependence on him. We needed him emotionally, psychologically, and that's why we kept reelecting the son of a bitch over and over again, because we kept seeing him as a strong man. So that's an example of where you can take some weakness. So you use it to shame and expose and bring down someone who has exalted himself and is using that self-exaltation to commit unrighteousness. So when we are referring to the right to privacy, we have to put something in the Constitution to explain that all exposition of someone else's nakedness is necessarily a violation of the right to privacy. Being a crippled is not in and of itself an evil. So he didn't commit a crime by being a cripple, obviously. But that nakedness is a reflection of a deeper unrighteousness he was committing. So therefore, it's no longer covered by the right to privacy. And I hope that kind of makes sense. The right to privacy is probably the murkiest of all the rights, as I've been meditating on each of the five fundamental rights: the right to life, the right to privacy, the right to property, the right to a fair reputation, and then the right to a personal domain. Out of those five rights, the five pillars, the second half of the 10 pillars, this right to privacy is probably the murkiest of them all. And the more subject to confusion, I would dare say, but we have to keep it simple. Basically, it's to protect your nakedness, your privacy, your private thoughts, your private relationships, but it doesn't protect unrighteousness. And whenever we embrace the right to privacy, we also have to embrace the concept of fidelity. And whenever that fidelity is violated, then the right to privacy is no longer a protection. As we said, the exposing of someone's nakedness to bring down their arrogance and to bring down the unrighteousness that they're committing against others. And if that nakedness is a reflection of the nakedness they're trying to bring to other people, the weakness that they're trying to bring to other people, it's fair game. Then it can be used. So that is basically the right to privacy, in a confused nutshell. And we hopefully shall continue with the right to property, the eighth pillar of the new American Constitution, in the next audio clip. Thank you very much.